John Purcell for Fred Joseph Cooper. May it please the court. I thought I would address three issues. The sufficiency of counts 2 and 4 of the indictment, whether they satisfy the Fifth Amendment, whether the court constructively amended the indictment, requiring a reversal of convictions under counts 2 and 4 through its instructions of the jury, and finally, whether the district court erred by denying Mr. Cooper's challenge for cause of juror number 19. Counts 2 and 4 charged Mr. Cooper with a firearms offense related to drug trafficking. Section 924 has two provisions, a use during and in relation to drug trafficking and a possession and furtherance provision. The indictment in both counts 2 and 4 conflated these two by charging in the body of the indictment possession during in relation and in relation to drug trafficking rather than use and carrying during in relation to drug trafficking.
This all boils down to whether we can consider the caption of the indictment, doesn't it?
Correct. And this court has held before in a previous decision in Fitzgerald that the caption can be read with the body of the indictment to determine whether or not the indictment is sufficient to satisfy the Fifth Amendment. But in Fitzgerald, there was no objection to the indictment below, so the indictment was read under a very liberal standard to determine whether under any reasonable reading of the indictment an offense had been charged. In this case, there was an objection below, so the liberal standard should not apply that was applied in Fitzgerald. And also in Fitzgerald, Fitzgerald was charged with a drug trafficking crime, possession with intent to distribute 5 or more grams of crack cocaine, I believe. The only element missing from the charge in the body of the indictment was the amount of crack cocaine alleged. In this case, and in Fitzgerald, the caption read possession of 5. It provided the missing element by providing for that the possession involved 5 grams or more. In this case, the caption actually contradicted the body of the indictment by charging possession in furtherance when the indictment charged possession during and in relation to. And unlike in Fitzgerald, where the caption clarified the body of the indictment, in this case, the caption actually, in some respects, contradicted the body of the indictment.
You need to just put in a gloss on what's in the body. I mean, the body said, in connection with?
The body of the indictment charged possession during and in relation to.
So in relation to, and this says in furtherance of, so I don't see that as a contradiction.
Well, under the two provisions, the during in relation offense requires use or carry, and the in furtherance provision requires mere possession of the firearm. This court has recognized in Ceballos-Torres, which was citing the Supreme Court in Bailey, that use or carry requires active employment of the firearm. Mere possession obviously doesn't. And also in this case, there was no evidence that Mr. Cooper actively employed the firearm. The government's theory of the case was a constructive possession, because it was in the house with the drugs and the money. But there was no active employment of the firearm during the offense. So the focus is whether the indictment, if read with the caption, broadens the charge to allow the government to convict on a mere possession charge when the body of the indictment under the during and in relation prong of the statute would require active participation, active use of the firearm during the offense, while the mere possession does not. So the at least applied to this case, the possession and furtherance was actually a broader charge than the use of the firearm during and in relation to the offense, because there was no evidence at trial that Mr. Cooper actively employed the firearm. And as the Supreme Court said in Bailey, use requires more than mere presence of the firearm or mere possession of the firearm in connection with the offense.
Despite these inconsistencies in the indictment, the district judge charged the jury with the correct law, correct? You don't have a complaint about the jury charge actually delivered to the jurors?
It was the jury charge was a correct statement of the possession and furtherance, but the jury should have been charged on the use and carrying during and in relation, because the court's charge of the possession and furtherance actually broadened the charge, because possession is a much broader basis of criminal responsibility than the use or carry provision of the statute. The use or carry provision would have required active employment, and there wasn't, and there was harm because there was no evidence that Mr. Cooper actively employed the weapon during the offense.
I mean, wouldn't it be harder for the government to prove in furtherance of charge than a possession charge?
Well, this court, I believe it was in McElberry, recognized that use and possession are two separate standards. And then in furtherance of and during in relation to are two separate standards. So this indictment conflated the possession standard with the use and carry, and my position is that the government should have been required to prove use and carry because the body of the indictment alleged the offense, the during in relation prong, which requires proof of use and carry.
I thought you were saying the body of the indictment didn't even charge an offense.
I do. I do allege that. I mean, that's my contention. At least under this court's precedent, it does fail to state an offense.
You mean without the use of the captions?
Correct. But I also contend that the caption shouldn't be used in this case because their error was preserved, and the indictment should not be read under the liberal standard applied under plain error. Because it also, the caption, unlike in Fitzgerald, which clarified the charge in the body of the indictment, the caption here actually had conflict with the charge contained in the indictment. So in Fitzgerald, reading the caption and the body under the plain error standard and the liberal standard, the liberal review applied, the indictment was clear in that case because it supplied that one simple missing element of the 5 grams, the amount of drugs involved. In this case, it created further ambiguity and at best conflicted with the body of the paragraph because the body of the paragraph suggested that the offense was a during in relation offense, which would require the active use of the firearm rather than a furtherance offense, which would require only the possession of the firearm.
And at what point did the defendant raise this problem?
He raised it at the close of the government's case. And as I addressed in the brief, under Rule 12b-3, the defendant is entitled to raise that objection at any time. And the Supreme Court's decision in Cotton, which addressed the jurisdictional issue, would not affect the provision of when a defendant may raise an objection to the form of an indictment and failure to allege an offense. And the Third Circuit, I believe, has held that a defendant may raise for the first time after the close of evidence the failure of the indictment to charge an offense, and I've cited those cases in the brief. And the charges in counts 2 and 4 did result in harm to Mr. Cooper because it resulted in a 360-month consecutive sentence to the 120 months that he had received under counts 1 and 5. So even if there's a harm analysis applied to a defective indictment, there was harm here because it resulted in an additional 360-month term of imprisonment. the issue of harm analysis was left undecided in McElberry. My argument would be that harm analysis shouldn't apply because if no offense is stated in the indictment, then the grand jury has not found probable cause that an offense was committed. Therefore, there hasn't been a properly returned grand jury indictment finding probable cause of criminal conduct. But even if the harm analysis does apply to the defect in the indictment, Mr. Cooper was sentenced to an additional 360 months based on his convictions of counts 2 and 4.
You didn't raise a sufficiency challenge, did you, to the conviction of possessing a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking charge?
No, Your Honor, I didn't. Under the law, the evidence would be sufficient given all the reasonable inferences.
I understand.
But we do contend that the court constructively amended the indictment by broadening the basis. The district court and the government have taken the position that the jury charge narrowed the basis of conviction because it focused on the in furtherance of the offense standard, which is narrower than the during and in relation prong. But by allowing a conviction of mere possession rather than requiring a evidence of use or carry, the court's instruction actually broadened, at least as applied to the facts of this case, the basis that the jury could convict on by allowing them to convict on the use and carry, by allowing them to convict based on mere possession rather than requiring the showing of.
Well, I don't know about broadening and narrowing, but tell me again why it was not harder for the government to prove possessing in furtherance of a drug trafficking offense rather than simply possessing a weapon in relation to an offense?
Oh, well, this court has held that possessing during and in relation is not an offense. So if the conduct required is a during and in relation, the government is required to prove at use or carry, which use or carry under the Bailey decision requires active employment of the firearm. And that's why it would be harder to convict for the government if they had charged use or carry during in relation. And use or carry is the correct standard of involvement of the firearm in a during and in relation offense.
All right, but if you look at it as though the body of the indictment doesn't charge an offense.
Correct.
It's hard to say that the charge broadened a non-existent offense.
Well, the broadening would go to whether or not the district court cured the defect in the indictment by instructing the jury. In McElberry, this court held that the district court did cure the defect in the indictment by instructing the jury. And in McElberry, the charge was the exact same as in this case, where alleged possession, during and in relation. And this court held that when the district court required the jury to find use or carry during and in relation, that it had cured the indictment. So this court did recognize, at least implicitly in that case, that it was the instruction that required the use or carry prong to prove a during and relation offense cured the defect in the indictment that was identically worded to the body contained in this indictment. So the two separate issues are, does it charge an offense, and then separately, second, does the district court's instruction cure any defect? My response is that the instruction broadened the basis that the government was allowed to convict on, and under the case law, the jury instruction can only cure a defect if it narrows the basis that the jury can convict on. But by allowing the jury to convict of mere possession rather than requiring a showing of actual active use and employment of the firearm, the district court broadened the charge and the basis that Mr. Cooper could be convicted on.
Have you abandoned your argument that an inoperable firearm can't be a predicate for the charge? I mean, we have case law, right?
Yeah, I'll concede that one. When I looked at it, I saw that the...
Let's simplify your life.
Right. That it's the didn't, there isn't a requirement that actually function. It just must be a firearm that could be functional. And if I may just briefly address the challenge for cause of juror 19, the juror did, by his statement, establish that there was actual bias when he stated that he did have trouble because of events in his past, which include a burglary of his home by African Americans that involved the gagging of his wife in a closet. That established actual bias. And when there is actual bias, the juror must affirmatively disavow any bias, and any doubt must be resolved against the juror and in favor of the defendant's right to an impartial jury. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Buzel, you've reserved time for rebuttal. Thank you for your argument. All right, we'll hear from the government. Mr. Turner. Did you try the case?
No, Your Honor, once again, owning this case by virtue of the fact that I'm the appellate attorney, so it's my case.
All right.
So you didn't draft the indictment?
I did not draft the indictment, and this is one instance which the judge was not, well, the grand jury was not well served by the drafting of this indictment.
You don't make the guy that drafts the indictment come up here and argue?
Oh, he had to come before us at my moot court and explain to me why he did this, but I'm here to help the district judge out, I hope, and help this court out recognize why this was a correct resolution by the district court. And the problem in this case, if I might begin, is the nature of the objection and the timing of it. Here, Mr. Cooper's attorney basically brought forward his Rule 12 motion at the same time he brought his Rule 29 motion. In the guise of challenging the sufficiency of the evidence, he raises for the first time his notice of the charge under Rule 12B, and as well as the failure to state an offense. And in this particular instance, it is critical, I think, for the court to consider the issue it reserved in McGilberry, that is whether 924C1 presents two different offenses or simply one offense. And this affects the jurisdiction. If, in fact, the grand jury, when it signaled its intent to invoke the court's jurisdiction under 924C1 as a possession in furtherance of a drug trafficking offense, the jurisdiction obstacles met, of course, notice is met as well, because he has notice at that time of the theory of the prosecution, that this is possession, it's in furtherance of. Thereafter, the error in the body of the indictment under Cotton, the Supreme Court instructs, it's not subject to automatic reversal now if there's an omitted element or an error in the allegation. Cotton is cited by the defendant here, and that was in terms of plain error, and of course, that was under Apprendi. That was the element, and an element is an element, and in this instance, the element is simply conflated. Here we conflate the in furtherance of and in the during and in relation to. So for the first time, the district court gets this objection. She gets it during the term of the time the motion for acquittal is raised. And her concern is, she said, the jury sits, she's heard the evidence is consistent with possession in furtherance of. In fact, there was a hint that the notice was satisfied early in the case. There's a footnote in the government's brief noting the fact that during its opening statement, the government attempted to present what it would prove under terms of possession and furtherance of. The objection was, that's not what the indictment says. But no objection was lodged at that time to the court's jurisdiction. And there was only a loose jurisdiction. So the allegation of jurisdiction, in terms of whether or not it adequately states an offense, here I would submit that it states an offense, but it states it incorrectly, but it can be corrected in this instance with the court's instructions.
But without the title of the indictment, it would not state an offense, would it?
It would not state an offense, no, Your Honor. There would be no notice at that time that it would state an offense, and then the court would have a more difficult time with the instructions. But in this particular instance, she can consider the caption. I think it's the timing of this objection affects this court's review of the issue. If the court had had notice earlier, it would have probably dismissed this indictment. If it had before the jury was impaneled, it would have been able to dismiss it without the prejudice of jeopardy attaching. But once that jury panel was impaneled, jeopardy becomes an issue. And that's not mentioned at all throughout the discussion, but in the end, the district judge felt that it had, citing McGilberry, she believed she had jurisdiction. There was no doubt about jurisdiction. Jurisdiction wasn't really pressed. She believed that the caption set out an offense. She construed the entire indictment, caption and body, and determined that this would be an reliance upon Cabrera-Ferrand is limited by virtue of Cotton and the rule that the a case that there's an error in the indictment with respect to an element doesn't require automatic dismissal on the basis of jurisdictional, one of jurisdiction.
And the charge that she gave to the jury was consistent with using the caption?
Yes, possession of furtherance of. And what the court did there was she acknowledged the possibility of constructive amendment, but she determined it was a variance. And this was probably a paradigmatic variance. The proof was consistent with the statute, consistent with the caption, and the instruction was a correct statement of the law.
What authority do you cite for the proposition that he should have raised it earlier?
Well, he can raise a Rule 12b-3. Well, the notice requirement probably should have been raised earlier. Under Rule 12b-3, it gives two exceptions to the timing of a motion challenging the institution of the indictment. It is fair to state an offense and a challenge to the jurisdiction. And the statement of an offense after Cotton, it becomes subject, I think, to a harmless error review as well if there's allegations in there that properly invokes the court's jurisdiction, because the offense can be stated with the caption and as well as the body of the indictment, which is what the district court did here when she fashioned her instructions around that, rely upon McGilberry. And I would also submit that this is the Seventh and the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit, in particular in Areola, has correctly found, and is consistent with this court's precedent in Munoz Romo, that 924C creates one offense committed two different ways. And what happened in this case in the body, that we confused the way in which the offense was committed. Instead of using carrying, and clearly the evidence was overwhelmingly sufficient that these weapons were positioned to further the drug transactions. And again, the court noticed that it was a variance. It's not a material variance because the defendant's substantial rights were honored. He was correctly instructed, charged, and tried under the statutory elements of the offense. With respect to the juror disqualification, I would briefly note that there was no reason why this juror could not have been peremptorily struck. There's nothing in the record that suggests that they needed an additional strike for cause. This was juror number 19, so he's relatively high in the list. Moreover, the district judge listened with great care to this and had a detailed finding with respect to her finding that this juror was not in any wise impartial or biased and would work very hard not to be so.
Defendant have some peremptories left over?
There's no record of that, Your Honor, and no record was made of it. No attempt was made of that. That wasn't raised or addressed from the record that I could gather in double-checking that. With the remaining issues, Your Honor, we would rest upon our brief. If the court has no additional questions, I would yield the remainder of my time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Attorney. Mr. Friesel, you have for both.
First issue I wanted to address was whether the Supreme Court's decision in Cotton precluded an analysis of this case as preserved error rather than forfeited error, waived error that would be reviewed under plain error. Cotton was only addressing the jurisdictional element of the indictment and said that the failure of the indictment to allege an offense was not a jurisdictional defect. But that decision did not relate to whether or not a defendant could object to an indictment for failing to charge an offense under 12b-3 at any time. It only addressed the jurisdictional component of what an indictment is and is not. But our challenge here isn't the jurisdictional element. So my position is that Cotton is not applicable to this case. And I cited the Third Circuit decisions in the brief addressing that very issue, that Cotton does not apply to a Rule 12b-3 motion based on a failure to charge an offense. Also, the government focused a bit on the notice provided by the indictment, but the issue is whether the grand jury charged an offense or did not charge an offense. Without a grand jury indictment charging an offense, there was no probable cause finding by the grand jury. I'm not arguing a notice provision, I'm arguing a failure of the indictment to charge an offense. The government's also argued that the court's instruction to the jury was merely a variance. Even if the instruction was only a variance, it was a material variance because it broadened the theory of conviction from a use theory of conviction, of active employment of the firearm theory, to a mere possession of a firearm theory. And that is a material variance because that requires different showing of different types of conduct, and the possession element is a much lower standard than the act of employment required by the use element. So my argument is that there was material variance, and it harmed Mr. Cooper because it resulted in the additional 360 months. And these arguments apply whether or not, even if 924 is a single offense with differing manners and means, the argument that there was material variance still applies. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Frizzell. The court does.